will be on case 28 in the Haitian Lu, the PN Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 28 is entitled, What the Holy Ones Have Not Yet Preached. Main subject, Nansen came to see Hyakujo Neihan Osho. Joe said, is there any Dharma that the Holy Ones have not preached to the people? Nansen said, there is. Joe said, what is the Dharma that has not been preached to the people? Nansen said, it is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things. Joe said, you have preached. Nansen said, I am just like this. How about you? Joe said, I am not a man of great wisdom. How can I tell if there is preaching or no preaching? Nansen said, I don't follow you. Joe said, I have talked quite enough for you. Secho's verse. Ancestors and Buddhas have not preached, yet monks run after preachers. Clear mirror on the stand, sharply imaging. Looking southward, see the great bear in the sky. The shaft hangs down. Where do you find it? Saving your nostrils, you have lost your mouth. So thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. This is what's known, if you're unfamiliar with Zen tradition, this is what's known as a koan. In the Zen tradition, we have different stages of practice. So when people first come here to learn how to meditate, we ask them to watch the breath. And eventually, people realize it's not so easy to watch the breath. You know, I've been doing Zen practice for 40 years, and when I started doing this and my teacher gave me the breath perception koan, watch the breath, I was really disappointed. You know, I expected something very mysterious and something very, very arcane. You know, I thought that my teacher would bring me into a room and give me like a secret teaching. And instead, I went into a room with him by myself for what we call dokusan, or the private interview with the teacher. And he said, watch your breath. And I was so disappointed because, as I say, I wanted something mystical. I wanted something that really mattered. You know, watching the breath seemed like infantile, right? And I felt a little bit insulted, like he was selling me short, you know. So anyway, I went back to my cushion and I watched the breath, and then I would go in to see the teacher, the Roshi, is the word for old teacher. And he would say, well, tell me about your breath. And I'd say, the breath goes in and the breath goes out. And in classical Zen training, when the interview is over, the teacher rings a little bell. And even if you're not done, if the teacher's done, he'll ring the bell. So I went in to see the teacher. His name was Genki Roshi. Went in to see the teacher, and I said to Genki Roshi, the breath goes in and the breath goes out. And he just went, you know, interview over. And that, I assumed, meant not a good answer. So, you know, the next time I came in, I said the same thing. I said, the breath goes in, the breath goes out, you know. O2 goes in, CO2 goes out. And, you know, I couldn't seem to give him an answer that would satisfy him. So, you know, I was an English major as an undergraduate, and I was in a graduate school. So I would write poetry. I would come in and read a poem. And sometimes I tried to be creative. I brought him a flower. I brought him a rock, and so on. You know, I couldn't answer this koan. And it took me many years actually to answer the breath perception koan. What actually happened was that I sat down on my cushion at some point in my training, and I just realized, you know, that when I really watched my breath, it disappeared. And if you haven't had this experience yet, I hope you'll try it. You know, I thought the breath was something I understood, because after all, I'd been breathing at that time I was 22. I'd been breathing for 22 years, no problem. And I thought, this is obvious. But, you know, when I sat down on the cushion and began to watch my breath, I began to realize it does strange things. So, you know, if you watch your breath, it does appear at times to go out your nostrils. But at other times, it doesn't go out your nostrils, or it doesn't feel like it's going out your nostrils. You know intellectually it has to be going out your nostrils. But, you know, when you're breathing out, you might feel like it's coming out of your forehead or coming out of the top of your head. So, you know, there's an understanding of the breath that we all have, which is part of our culture. You know, if you took a sixth grade biology class, you learned about oxygen and CO2. If you took a biology class, you know about the lungs and so on. But when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, you can have a totally different experience of the breath. It's not what you necessarily expected. And even though I'm telling you about my experience of the breath, you know, your experience of the breath can be and probably will be somewhat different. You know, so, you know, years after my teacher gave me this koan, this subject for meditation, said, watch your breath. Tell me where, he used to say, I would come in and I'd say, the breath goes in, the breath goes out. And he'd look like, you're really stuck. And then he'd say, breath with eyes, where do you go? And I just didn't get the hint, you know. So it took years and years. And one day, I was just sitting on the cushion and I was watching my breath, and I realized that when I watched my breath, the breath seemed to disappear. And that was a great discovery for me. It was like, as I was watching my breath, the breath just disappeared. And later, you know, I was working with other koans. So there's a koan, basically, where the teacher says, listen, just listen to sounds. And when I was listening to a sound one day, trying to answer this koan, it was like I fell off a cliff. It just felt like dropping right off a cliff. And my mind became absolutely blank. So, you know, I started out thinking I knew what the breath was. And when I began to practice, I brought to my practice all of these presuppositions about what should be happening. And this is so common in everything we do. You know, so, you know, the other night I was watching a movie, and it was about two people in love. The movie was like filled with cliches. It was just like one cliche after another. And if you watch that movie and you took it seriously, you know, you might think, I know everything there is to know about falling in love. You know, but actually, you know, when I first met my wife, you know, it didn't work like the movie at all. You know, it was very, very different. And you know, the more you want your story to be like the story in the movie, the less you're able to be present with what's actually happening. See, so a lot of Zen is learning how to be present with what's actually happening and getting out of your own way, you know, getting out of your own way, because we want the story we think we should get. You know, what I thought was going to happen is that the teacher gave me this breath koan, and I'd go, okay, the breath goes in and the breath goes out, and he'd say, great. Now let's go on to a real koan with some special mystical secret at the heart of it. But, you know, when I began to watch the breath, I realized the breath is much stranger than I thought. You know, when I watch the breath, it disappears. When I listen to sound, it disappears. Or that's what it seemed to be the case. You know, so you know, Zen is really about, like, radical experientialism. It's kind of a philosophical idea. But it's based on, you know, when you're practicing Zen, you want to stay very close to what's actually happening from moment to moment. And, you know, we want to make what's happening fit the familiar stories or assumptions we have. So, you know, it's difficult actually to be a good Zen student, because you have to sort of sit with the experience you're focusing on for a long time before you realize how false your assumptions about it really are. You know, it took me a number of years before I just accidentally realized that my breath wasn't what I thought it was. You know, the breath is supposed to go out our nostrils, but sometimes it goes out your forehead. You know, when I was working on the koan, I just kept giving Genki Roshi the same answer, but one time we were coming home from a sesshin, a meditation retreat, and we were all riding together in a friend's truck. My friend's name was Gina. She was a professional dancer with a dance troupe in Seattle. And on the way home, we were all talking about the sesshin, the retreat we just attended, and you're not supposed to talk about your koan training with anybody but your teacher, but she blabbed that she went in to see Genki Roshi. She was working on the breath koan, and she gave the answer peach, peach. So she was watching her breath, and peach was what turned up. She went into the Roshi, and he was thrilled. He said, that's a wonderful answer. So later, I gave him the answer peach, too, and he knew I had stolen it from her. And I felt like such a jackass, you know. But, you know, somehow she had had a deep experience of oneness with her breath. And that was how she expressed it to the teacher. And because I had so many presuppositions and assumptions, you know, I couldn't really have a direct and on self-conscious encounter with my breath. Because, you know, I was striving to be a good Zen student. I wanted to impress Genki Roshi with my incredible insight, and so on and so on. And I wanted to have an answer that would knock his socks off. And because I was so obsessed with how he thought of me, you know, I wasn't able to be present with the breath. You know, and, you know, at first it seemed to me that I understood the breath. And then later, you know, I had this experience of feeling like when I watched the breath, it disappeared. You know, now that I've been watching my breath for 40 years, I realize that when you watch the breath, what really disappears is you. You know, or it's also true that when you watch your breath, you know, your sense of yourself disappears. So all much stranger than we might think, this simple task of watching the breath. You know, sometimes the breath disappears, but if you're really watching the breath, you disappear. And really, after 40 years, I would say that's really the essence of what we're up to in Zen. So, you know, in Zen practice, the teacher usually gives people the breath perception koan first, until they are able to forget the self, to get out of their own way. And you can't say, all right, I'm going to forget myself. I'm going to get out of my own way. Because just saying that is about yourself, right? So in fact, if you try to be mindful or you try to be selfless, it's a very self-conscious undertaking. So, you know, the way we get over ourselves is to sit on the cushion, watch the breath until you enter samadhi. Samadhi is this state where the thinking part of your mind begins to recede, and it's more of a state of pure awareness. So, you know, at first when you sit down on the cushion, the thoughts are right at the center of your consciousness, and the breath is over to the side. If you keep practicing, the thoughts shift over. They shift over to the side, and the breath becomes more at the center of your consciousness. And at some point, you know, you become one with your breath. You know, at some point the breath is going to disappear, but it's also going to be true that at some point you become one with the breath. And what that means is that your own self-consciousness disappears. When you can enter samadhi and your self-consciousness momentarily disappears as you merge with the object of your attention, you've gone to like stage one of Zen practice. So stage one is usually achieved by watching the breath, and people usually enter into samadhi. The self disappears, thoughts move to the side of your consciousness, and the object of your attention is right at the center of your consciousness, and you merge with the center, you merge with the object of your consciousness. So this is samadhi. This is like step one in Zen. And then after that, the teacher gives you what are called koans. Koans. So koans are like little stories, like this one. And at the heart of these little Zen stories, there's like a kernel or a phrase that you internalize like a mantra. You go into samadhi and then you say the phrase. So in this case, this is a complicated story. Let me just go through it. Nansen is a very famous Tang Dynasty Zen master. And he went to see Hyakujo, or Obaku. Hyakujo is Baijiang, Nanchuan and Baijiang. Okay. So Nansen went to see Hyakujo, and they're both great Zen masters, very famous in their day for being deeply awake. So this is an encounter between two people who have been practicing forgetting the self, merging with the object of attention, and entering emptiness over and over again for a long time. So Nansen came to see Hyakujo. Hyakujo said, he's testing his friend to see how deep his friend's insight is. He says, is there any truth that the holy ones of Buddhism have not yet preached to the people? See, so this is a question testing his friend's depth of understanding. Is there any truth that about reality that has not yet been preached to the people? And Nansen says, yes, there is. And Joe said, what is it? Nansen says, it's not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things. So, you know, this is really the method of Zen, see? When you sit down on the cushion, you know, you naturally have expectations about what's going to happen. After you enter samadhi the first time, it's such a beautiful experience. You know, so the first time you enter, if you practice meditation regularly for like a month or two, you know, like multiple times a week, and you come in and you sit down on the cushion, you know, one day you're just going to have this beautiful, sometimes a really blissful experience. When the self disappears and you merge yourself with the object of your attention, it feels like going home. It feels like the most wonderful, reassuring, a delicious experience. And, you know, I've had people actually come up after a sitting period and say to me, wow, what was that? You know, and I'll say, that's samadhi. It's like, wow. And then, of course, after people have that experience, they think, well, this Zen is great. You know, I'm going to sit down and have samadhi every time. So they come in and they sit down and they don't have samadhi. And people might go through a period where they just feel this disappointment. And they'll come to see me and say, you know, I had that wonderful samadhi experience and it's never come back. And if I ask them, well, when you had that experience, what was going on? And they usually say, well, I was just watching my breath. And I say, well, when you practice now, what's the difference? You know, the difference is they're waiting for samadhi. So, you know, the first time they had their samadhi experience, they sat down on the cushion with no expectations for or against anything. And this experience just leapt up out of nowhere. And they were in this blissful state. You know, the next time they come to the cushion, it's like, okay, samadhi, let's go. You know, I want that bliss, you know. And of course, doing this creates an obstacle. Now you're forming a mental picture of what should be happening. See? And so you can't be in the moment openly and honestly. The self can't merge with the object of its attention. And you can't disappear because you've got a script. And of course, if you think, I'm going to have a blissful sit, that's almost a formula for having a lousy sit. Right? Because you're going to sit down on the cushion and think, okay, I'm, you know, where's the bliss? And then you're going to realize, oh, my leg really hurts today, you know? And then you have lots of thoughts in your head, and you can't get rid of your thoughts. And by the end of 35 minutes, you might be really bummed out. You know, it's like, well, this is no good. Yeah, this is Zen. You know, this is no good. But it's not Zen, it's your presuppositions. So, you know, I have to get my Zen master straight here. When non-Zen asks, when Hyakujo asks non-Zen, is there any dharma, is there any teaching that the holy ones have not yet preached? See, he's really saying to his friend, do you understand the basic method of Zen? And of course, he does. He says, whatever presuppositions you have you have to get them out of the way. So he says, it's, you know, you could say, what is the truth of Buddhism? And he says, Buddha, mind, and so on and so on. None of those things are the truth of Buddhism. In other words, you know, if you cling to any presupposition, it's going to become an obstacle. You won't be able to be fully present on the cushion. You know, and this is something that's very difficult for human beings to do. You know, people are a little bit naive about how difficult it is to do. It's very, very hard, actually, for people to be spontaneous and for people to be natural. You know, the other day I was going through some photos that my mother sent me before she passed away. And it was a bunch of photos of me and my brother and my sister and a lot of our friends when we were teenagers. And, you know, we all thought of ourselves as these rebels. We all thought of ourselves as like rebellious. We were rebelling. We were really individuals, right? And, you know, our parents, you know, they listened to Frank Sinatra, that stuff is for squares, you know. We listened to Deep Purple, right? You know, we're really hip, we're really rebels. I looked at the photos, we were all dressed exactly the same way, right? We all had long hair, we all had shirts without collars, right? You know, that had buttons in the front, right? Or we had tie-dye t-shirts and bell bottoms, right? And sandals, right? So, you know, we weren't really the rebels we thought we were, you know. We were imitating each other, you know, and we were really imitating our idols, you know, people like Mick Jagger and the Beatles, you know. And in fact, you wouldn't want to be caught dead with a certain kind of clothes, because they weren't fashionable, right? So, we thought that we were rebels. We thought that we were doing something totally new and interesting, but we were really just imitating each other. And, when I got out of college, I hitchhiked across the United States. And my inspiration for doing that was my reading of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, this wonderful book. But I can't tell you how many people I met on the side of American highways in the late 70s, all hitchhiking, and we could all sit there and talk about Jack Kerouac's novel, right? So, there's nothing wrong with this. We're social beings, right? We're social animals. I try to dress in ways that are acceptable at my workplace, and I don't wear those clothes at home, But on the other hand, we're all social animals, and we want to be acceptable. We want to do the right thing, be in the right place and say the right thing. But those qualities make it very hard for us sometimes to be spontaneous and be natural and be absolutely present in the moment. So when I was beginning to do Zen practice, I really wanted to be a great Zen practitioner. I wanted to be like these Zen masters I read about in the books on Zen. Alan Watts' Way of Zen, he has all these descriptions of these great Zen masters who slap each other in the face and put shoes on their head and walk out the door backwards. And I just thought, something's going on with those guys. It looks really cool, I also thought that I was pretty unhappy at that time in my life, and I thought, maybe this would make me happier. So I had a combination of motives, but I definitely wanted to be very good at doing Zen. And, when I was in school, I was always a very good student, so I wanted to be a good Zen student. But, the harder I tried to impress my teacher, the less natural I was, and the less capable I was of answering the question. If you do Zen practice, you'll go through this process again and again. The teacher will give you a koan, and you internalize the koan after you can enter samadhi, and you just wait for an answer to pop up, believe it or not. You will maybe try to figure it out intellectually, or maybe you will read something in a book on Zen and give the answer to the teacher. But sooner or later, if you really work on Zen, sooner or later you're going to reach a dead end, right, where you just feel like, I can't answer this koan. And you'll go into the Dokusan room where you have your private interview with the teacher, and you'll present the answer you have, and the teacher will say, I'm sorry, that's not an acceptable answer. You go back to your cushion and you just think, that's it, I'm out of ammunition. I don't have any more ideas. I don't know what to do. I'm really a big Zen failure. And, actually, that's when people usually answer their koans. It's because they really get out of the way when you sort of like give up the aspiration to be successful at this game. You have to stay on the cushion. But if you sort of like give up the aspiration to be successful at this game, it's possible to be spontaneous, to have a fresh, open-eyed encounter with the moment, which is really what Zen is all about. So, it's difficult for us to do that because we want to bring the equipment we have with us to the koan. I've had students who are like philosophers, and it takes them a long time to give up the habit of being a philosopher, And some people have been trained as scientists. Scientists are very inductive, and that's a good thing. But even they, you know, even scientists can have sort of like a rigidity of mind, sort of rigidity. We all have our mental rigidities. So, you know, everybody has to go through this process of losing control over the situation, and then gradually giving up and having an honest encounter. You know, so if you read books on Zen, you know, it's quite possible to form an image of somebody who's deeply enlightened. Maybe you've read some of the books by the Dalai Lama. You know, the Dalai Lama is a wonderful person, and he's a charming guy. You know, many, many years ago, 30 years ago or something around 30 years ago, the Dalai Lama wasn't quite the rock star he's become now. And he actually came to our Zen Center in Seattle and sat with us, you know. He was really an unpretentious person, and doesn't try to be mysterious or special in any way, you know. He came here to Rutgers, and they had an event for him they actually held it in the stadium. Something like 200,000 people showed up. And the Dalai Lama, when he's doing that kind of a public performance, has sort of a style. He's sort of funny, and he's charming and cute, right? But he didn't really present himself the way he presented himself to us at the Zen Center, you know, which was very down to earth, very matter of fact. When he does his public routine, he sort of plays the great Buddhist master, and you know, people form all kinds of fantasies about what the Dalai Lama can and cannot do. And, you know, sometimes those fantasies are a good thing because it gets them to sit down on a cushion and try meditation. You know, we have a member of our group whose name is Jaru, and she invited me to give a lecture at her class when she used to teach here at the here at Rutgers. And at the end of the class, somebody actually asked me if Zen, this sounds ridiculous, but somebody actually asked me if Zen masters can fly. Because he had read a book where it said, you know, basically these great Buddhist masters can fly through the air. And this is not so uncommon. You know, there's actually in the Christian tradition, and in the Islamic tradition, there's also these legends of people who can fly through the air. And I disappointed him profoundly because I said, yes, they can fly, but only if they get on an airplane. And he looked so crestfallen, right? So, you know, I'm not willing to string him along and say, well, you know, maybe so. You know, you should try meditation, you know. I think that would be unprincipled. But I couldn't, after telling him, you have to take a plane to fly, I couldn't get him to try meditation. So, but you know, everybody brings to everything these presuppositions. And we have to, you know, strip them away. A friend of mine was telling me about his training at a Zen center in California. It's called Green Gulch, and he is quite elderly now. He's about 85 years old. He's a former brain scientist. Some of you have heard me talk about John Sunston, but he said that he had been training for a while at this Zen Center, a beautiful place in California, and he said, while they were meditating, they had like a little earthquake. And he said his first thought was that he was having an enlightenment experience. And then people grabbed him and said, you know, you got to get out of the building, it might fall on your head. So, you know, Zen practice is really about learning how to disappear on the cushion. And when you disappear, you merge with the object of your attention. And this process goes on and on. You know, ordinarily, even though people don't necessarily notice this, you know, ordinarily we feel somewhat separate from everything around us all the time. You know, so, when you begin to do meditation practice, you might begin to be aware of this, you know. I have to go to these meetings. I have an administrative job at Rutgers. And, you know, sometimes I have to go to meetings all day. And I go to some of these meetings, and I don't even know what the meetings are about when I sit down. And, you know, I don't even know what they're about when I leave. Because they just go on, and it's like, why are we having this meeting? You know, what is this really about? And I have to confess that in some of these meetings, I really check out, you know. Like, I always have a pad of paper with me, and if things get too boring, I start doing these designs on the paper, you know. And they're really often quite beautiful. I actually have gotten really good at this. And you know, I'm checked out. So, you know, in one corner of my mind is still listening to the conversation. One corner of my mind, it's like 25% of my mind or 15% of my mind is present in the conversation. 15% of my mind is thinking about lunch, right? And 15%, you know, the rest, whatever that would be, 60% or 70%. Is focused on my design, right? So, you know, I'm not 100% present. And I think this is very common. You know, typically we're not 100% present. You know, we always sort of like hold back a little bit. You know, sometimes we're holding back not because we're bored, but because we're afraid, right? You know, so when I was young, I'm pretty much of an introvert. So it was difficult for me to go into a room full of strangers and sort of, you know, be friendly and jovial. You know, I would enter a room, and when I would enter a room, I'd actually feel more alone. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. You know, some people just don't have that personality. But, you know, being in a room of unfamiliar people made me feel more alone rather than less alone. And that sense of separation would really grow. It's like, you know, your baseline sense of separation is, you know, maybe you're always about 50% present, you know. In a situation like that, you're sort of like 10% present. Or when people are frightened, you know, they definitely dissociate quite a bit, you know. When people are afraid or anxious, you know, they withdraw quite a bit from the world around them. You know, if you're really anxious and somebody tells you something, you might not even remember what they said. In fact, you know, if you're really anxious, this has actually happened to me. You know, I was in a car accident, and it wasn't anything serious. But when I got home, I realized my legs were covered with bruises. You know, I had withdrawn so much from my surroundings that I wasn't even really aware of my body. You know, later when I was more relaxed and a little bit more open, I looked down and I realized, wow, my legs have really gotten banged up. So, you know, we're able to dissociate or separate ourselves from the world around us, and we do it all the time. And we create like a habit of being somewhat sort of like mildly dissociated all the time. And at certain points, we become, you know, more intensely dissociated. But it's actually very rare to sort of like stop dissociating, because we have this protective mechanism, right? You know, we've learned how to put up boundaries. So, you know, it takes, as I said a little earlier, it takes a lot of effort to sort of be 100% present in the moment. It's not necessarily something we ordinarily do. Like in exceptional circumstances, we connect with the world around us, usually spontaneously and by accident. So you're hiking one day, you turn and you look at the mountains, and your guard is down and you just become one with the mountains. But generally that's difficult to achieve. And so, you know, the Zen way of life is constantly to take down our barriers. And when we take down those barriers, we feel, experience it as like a disappearance of the self. You know, the self is really just, this sounds a little odd to put it this way, but what we call the self is really just the barrier we create. You know, in other words, you know, we develop this habit of creating a wall between ourselves and the world, a little bit of dissociation to protect ourselves. And you know what? That little bit of dissociation is actually the self. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you begin to watch your breath, you have all these assumptions and presuppositions. But, you know, gradually those move away and you begin to be able to be present, fully present in the moment. And, you know, instead of being like 60% present and 40% dissociated, you're gradually like 80% present, 20% dissociated, 90% present, 10% dissociated. And when you get into that zone, you begin to feel really great. And when the dissociation disappears, you know, what we call the self also disappears. And there's this sort of like merging with the world around you. That's that blissful feeling. But the way to get there, actually, is to go through this process of, you could say, being lost, or being dumbfounded, or being confused. You know, there was a famous Zen teacher named Sung San. He was a Korean. And he's famous for his teaching of, he just said, Zen is about don't know, don't know. And he wrote a book called Don't Know. You know, and what he really means is, you know, as long as you think you understand what your breath is, you can't have you're still dissociating from your breath. You're using ideas to separate yourself from the moment. And you know, when you begin to realize, I have no idea what the breath is, you know, you're beginning to take down those barriers between yourself and the breath. And usually, this is challenging, because this has this is challenging because we are losing control, and that's a little frightening. And being disoriented is often an uncomfortable feeling. So, you know, when the Zen teacher says you don't have the answer and you go back to your cushion and you feel despondent and you feel lost, you know, if you come into the Zen teacher and you say, I feel totally lost, if you say it to me, I'll be so happy. Because that means something new can happen. You're beginning to take down that barrier, and now you can have a real encounter with the world around you. So, you know, this process never ends. You know, people think of enlightenment as something that happens to them decisively and then it's done, right? So, you know, when people think about enlightenment, they imagine it's, you know, in Western mystical tradition, there are these moments where, like, you know, the divine descends and into somebody, right? And that's very Western way of thinking about things. It's not at all like the Buddhist way of thinking about things. You know, from the Buddhist standpoint, there really is such a thing as enlightenment, but it's not something that happens and then it's over. It's like this. You sit down on the cushion and you're watching the breath, and your ideas and assumptions disappear. You become one with the breath. You stop thinking about yourself and you feel like you've gone home. That's enlightenment. That's an enlightenment experience. See, so then, you know, you come back to the cushion and you want to repeat that experience. Now you've closed it up again. So you have to go back to zero again. You have to go back to not knowing. And, basically, if you sit in that emptiness, you sit in that state of not knowing over and over again. You keep having the experience, this experience of merging with the object of your awareness. And in Zen practice, you know, we do this over and over and over again. It's like every time you go through this process, you connect with the world a little more deeply, a little bit more openly, and a little bit more completely. But there's no moment at which this process is over. You know, we have to constantly peel back our assumptions and our expectations. You know, one Zen teacher I study with said, the human being is like an oyster. You know, we secrete a protective shell of ideas and assumptions the same way an oyster secretes, basically its shell. And we have to constantly open the oyster up again, you know. So this process of emptying yourself out, being empty, being uncertain, you just keep returning to this process over and over again. And every time you do it, you connect more deeply with the world. So, you know, your sense of connection gets deeper, 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 deeper. And it's also the case that your attachment to this fictional character called the self, which is created by your dissociation from the world, you become a little less wedded, a little less attached to that as well. So the last part of this koan, let me just get to the last part of this koan. These are two Zen teachers, and they're having an exchange. And one Zen teacher says, basically, is there any teaching that the holy ones have not yet preached? And Nansen said, yes, there is. And he says, well, what is it? And he said, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. In other words, just keep cutting away at your assumptions. And our way of doing that is by entering emptiness. And Joe says, you have preached. Nansen said, I am like this. How about you? They begin to have this sort of like exchange that doesn't necessarily make much sense. But when you read exchanges between Zen masters, it sounds like each of them is trying to get the upper hand over the other. You know, so one Zen master will say this, and the other guy will say this, and it looks like a competition. In fact, I've even heard people describe this as Dharma combat. But it's not Dharma combat. You know, the art of a good teacher is that he can help the student become confused. So, you know, both of these teachers are saying something to the other that is confusing, or that it's like disorienting. So there are two Zen masters trying to disorient each other. But don't think this is aggression. This is how people wake up. You know, when you do Zen practice in a formal way, in the formal way that we use here with koans, you know, your reward for answering your koan is a new koan. So as soon as you feel like you've got it, you know, a good teacher will say, that's great, and now it's time to be confused again. Sometimes life itself is quite confusing. So those are like real koans. But the practice of Zen is basically living in that confusion, living in that openness. Nansen came to see Hyakujo. Jo said, is there any Dharma that the holy ones have not preached to the people? Nansen said, there is. Jo said, what is the Dharma that has not been preached to the people? Nansen said, it is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things. So get rid of your presuppositions. Jo said, but you've just preached. Nansen said, I am like this. How about you? So he's changing the subject. Jo said, I am not a man of great wisdom. How can I tell if there's preaching or no preaching? Changing the subject. Nansen said, I don't follow you. Changing the subject. Jo said, I've talked quite enough for both of us. Changing the subject. So both of them are sort of like pulling the rug out from each other and having the rug pulled out from you is the best thing that can happen, because you can have an authentic experience of the world. Secho's verse, patriarchs and Buddhas have not preached, yet monks run after preachers. In other words, people are looking for certainty, right? Certainty. Clear mirror on the stand, sharply imaging. Looking southward, see the Great Bear. See, the mind has this mirror-like aspect. Looking southward, you see the expanse of the sky. The shaft hangs down. Where do you find it? Saving your nostrils, you have lost your mouth.